Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Quote, if you simply go here and go to class and do your assignments and go home, I'm not sure you really should be here. So observed my colleague and guest today, Professor Philip Voigt, co-chair of the Communication Studies Department at Gustavus, in encouraging students to take full advantage of the myriad events, co-curricular activities, and service opportunities Gustavus offers them. Dr. Voigt knows whereof he speaks, having graduated, as we will hear, from a liberal arts college himself. He joined the Gustavus faculty in 1990 and quickly made his mark in the classroom and as the director of forensics and speech and debate coach. His course topics have included advertising and society, American political humor, gay and lesbian communication, political campaign communication, and reality TV, to name just some. And he has also taught travel courses in London, South Africa, India, and Cambodia and Vietnam. Under his direction, Gustavus Forensics has excelled nationally and internationally, and his commitment to and achievements in the field have won him numerous awards, including the L.E. Norton Award, recognizing scholarly contributions to forensics, and both the Presidential Service Award and Forensics Coaching Achievement Award from Pi Kappa Delta, the field's venerable professional organization, which he has served as president and chief operating officer. In addition to publishing and presenting extensively in his field, he has authored and directed major grants totaling hundreds of thousands of dollars for various Pi Kappa Delta initiatives. Our offices are adjacent in Beck Hall. His has the Sirius coffee making machine. And I know from conversations both with him and overheard that he not only cares deeply about Gustavus and its students, but also thinks creatively and strategically about the college now and ahead. I especially value his energy, intellect, and cosmopolitan outlook, and I'm delighted he could join me for this conversation. So welcome, Phil. It's really great to have you on.
Thank you, Greg. That's such a nice introduction. I can't believe it.
My pleasure. Anyone who has a coffee machine like you have in your office is a friend of mine. Anyway, you have a great office. I sometimes wish we could do visuals so people could see your office, all the good stuff that's in it. Welcome. So you, like me, were teaching at least during, I don't know if you were on leave at all in any part of the pandemic when we had to abandon campus, but I'd like to start with colleagues by asking how that went for you. How was teaching and learning for you as a comp studies prof during the height of COVID?
Yeah, boy, you know, it was really rough. I don't know about your classes, but I'd spent the prior 6-8 years trying to strip technology out of my courses.
Oh, God.
So when we got back in, spring of 2020, and they said, well, we're going to take a long spring break and then you'll be teaching online, it was a real eye-opener. But I will say, I do think there are some things that I picked up during the pandemic that I'm going to keep, or some pieces, like the opportunity to have short embedded segments on video or appearances, guest appearances by people that you would never be able to get in contact with in ordinary times, but they're able to do that during the pandemic. So that was a great opportunity, but it was rough, I will say.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't expect you to say you had been trying to strip technology. I figured you'd be all tech, unlike me. Totally agree with what you just said, though, and that's been kind of a theme among our colleagues. You know, what we will continue to use. I used Moodle only in the most minimal sense, that whatever we call that, our learning platform. But I definitely am using, what you just described, sort of embedded videos and things like that, really, I think, enhances what I'm trying to do in ways I never would have done probably without having to do it because of the pandemic. So
I have gone totally from a very stripped down Moodle site to now I'm loading it up with extra podcasts and supplemental materials, a lot of things that aren't required. And I'm just having a ball with some of my courses, finding little historical pieces. So it really has been eye-opening. And the other part that I thought was really interesting, I found my own frustration taking an online course as a faculty member at the what I think is kind of the idiocy of the discussion board. I find that forum to be so unfortunate and so mechanical and so useless. And but using some other pieces like perusal, I think, leads to a much more interesting discussion, right? I'm not going to use it for the grading part of it, but I really do want you to embed comments directly in the article and use that as a vehicle for discussion rather than this kind of artificial, you know, post a comment and reply right. to other people's we had to do that in an online course I took this summer, and I understand why students are so frustrated with that. I found that quite quite frustrating.
I did do that. What was that called? Moodle forum post or something.
Yes.
I did do that, and it felt very mechanical. I agree. So I may go your route instead. But yeah, you know, I went from being, what do I need? I mean, I guess I'm not a Luddite. I shouldn't say, what do I need technology for? I use technology just a little bit, but to using it much more, and will probably, you know, continue to do so. I certainly did last fall when I finally went back in person. We got through it, hopefully. Hopefully
yes.
We'll get through the next pox, monkey pox.
Pandemic.
Oh, yes. My God. It's just unbelievable. I don't know. I found I'm actually tired of this word resilience and resiliency, but my students, at least, I mean, for the most part, rose to the occasion. I honestly didn't feel I was having any issues other than, you know, some technical issues where a student maybe couldn't, you know, get online or something. But you know, they rose to the occasion for the most part. So I didn't experience kind of some of the meltdowns we've read about. Maybe some of our right. colleagues did. I didn't find that.
No, and you know, maybe it's the kind of place we teach at, but strangely, I've never been more available. The students are like, can I meet with you? I'm like, I'm literally not leaving this house for the next 6 days. So yes, call me any time of the day or night. I will be available.
That's right. Yeah, just leave our screens on and our cameras on. And you know, that's funny. Well, here's – and you're coming back in the fall. You're not on leave, or are you?
No, I'm not on leave. I'm coming back in the fall. And I wasn't on leave during the pandemic.
Okay.
But yeah. Strangely, we were in Vietnam doing the Vietnam-Cambodia course when the pandemic started.
Right,
I remember. Even though I'd seen what it did there, you could have knocked me over with a feather when we actually shut down. You know, I really, in my mind, I never kind of understood how dramatic the consequences would be for Gustavus.
Yeah.
And somehow I always just thought this would be contained, and it's not, you know. The Chinese strategy of containing this in Asia is going to be successful. And it was just a really surprise to me how rapidly it spread and how dramatically it spread.
Yeah, it. I'm half Greek, so I can't say it surprised me. I guess sometimes I expect the worst. But, and the historian in me thinking about 1918 and the government's response, some of the parallels. But yeah, it was striking how fast it happened. That's for sure. But without it, I sometimes wonder would I be doing this podcast, because that's kind of how the podcast started. I felt I had a little extra time, so I started the podcast. We are.
That's another good thing that's a carryover of the pandemic. I'm doing all of these advising podcasts that are just really, really short audio nuggets, and they're totally optional. But I'm going to start embedding those things in Moodle too. You want extra tips on how to start this assignment, or here's a good place to go for evidence on this particular argument. And just putting those things on Moodle, because they're short, and we found with video, students won't watch them. But if they're audio and it's something I can play on my way to the canteen, or I could do it on my way to work out or something like that, it's easy for me to access. So,
well, that's interesting. I know you do podcasting and certainly work it into your teaching. You know, I was just about to ask you, are those podcasts video as well? And you answered it. So that's interesting to me.
The video ones really didn't get any play, because they actually had to sit there at the computer and do it.
And
we kind of said, look, here's an interesting one. Like one of the reality television courses, there's a separate podcast called Running from the Cops, and it's about how people's lives are affected by participation in a reality show like Cops. And so I started putting little audio segments like that up, and I found that the people that watched it on video would maybe two out of a class of 16 would watch it, but the audio one, almost all of them watched it. So we're like, audio it is.
Well, you're affirming my decision for now to continue audio only with this podcast, because Zencastr has a feature where you can do video as well. But maybe I don't have to worry about that.
Well, the other secret too, my colleague Mark would say also, I don't know anything about audio, or I don't know anything about video production. And so it would be really hard for me to edit it.
Yeah, that's true too. That's certainly true of me. It's all interesting. Very interesting I'm even thinking of doing some, as you've done, some podcasting assignments, maybe in addition to embedding little snippets here and there and on Moodle. We'll see. So tell us a little bit about you. I mean, I know it's so funny doing this podcast. I learned so much about people. I think I know, but I don't really know that well, even though you and I have, I don't know, been next door to one another for a long time. We knew each other before then. But tell us a little bit about where you grew up, your background, and how you became interested in speech and debate, or what's called comp studies.
So I was born and raised in South St. Paul, and that was actually where I became first interested in speech and debate. We had a strong speech and debate tradition in the high school, and so I joined that in ninth grade. And
what high school was it?
South St. Paul. It's our only public school, so it was a public high school there. And at the time, it was kind of, South St. Paul is a federally depressed city. It was a stockyard city.
Right.
The stockyards
closed. That's what I think of it, yeah.
Yeah, it was a one-company town. And so during the time I went to high school, it was really a period of great economic malaise for the city. But strangely, it was the tail end of all of that SWIFT and ARMOR funding that funded the schools. So we had a really, really robust public education system. We had four languages that were taught. We had advanced math and science. We had all of the industrial arts. So we had a plastic shop and a metal shop and an auto shop. Really, when I look back on it, that was amazing education. Full funding for things like speech and debate, travel and theater. So it was really a great place to grow up in kind of unusual circumstances for the town. I'm sure it wasn't a great time to be a city leader, but it was a great place to grow up.
And let me interject. It's another reminder that money does make a difference when it comes to public education. I can't stand it when I hear people say, well, money isn't the answer. Really? Exactly. And these are usually people who are sending their kids to very well-endowed public schools or private schools where money makes all the difference. I mean, it's money that made all of those programs possible.
Right.
And the travel possible, as well as good, dedicated teachers, of course.
And there was also an ethic, too, I think, on behalf of the people at SWIFT and ARMORS, and the workers there were fully willing to support taxes for higher taxes than normal for educational programs, because they didn't want their kids working on the line.
Right.
You know, you always had, why is your kid learning Russian? Well, I don't want them working at the bacon line or something.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's very interesting. So were your parents were involved in the packing industry, or were they?
All of my aunts were in the packing. My great aunts, I'm sorry, my mother's aunts were all employees down there. And my grandfather was a truck driver for Swift and Company. Oh, yeah. My grandmother on my mother's side worked at some of the bars right outside of the stockyards early in her life. And then later on, she worked at Dayton. So, but my parents weren't. My dad worked his entire career. Started right after high school, a week after high school, West Publishing, worked his entire career there.
Wow.
And my mom worked at a bank, and she worked in some retail establishments, and she did sewing, and she did home child care.
All kinds of different things. Did your dad spend his whole career with West, which is not, what's it called? Is it still West?
It's, I can't remember. Thomson Reuters.
Thomson
now.
Reuters, right. Yeah.
Literally started in the mailroom.
Wow.
And eventually wound up pretty high in that company. But the funny story that he tells is he went there by mistake. He was supposed to go to Western Printing. His print shop instructor said, hey, you're really good at this. And I promise you, if you go in and you tell him that Harry Sam sent you, you can get a job there. And he went to West Publishing instead of Western Publishing. And they're like, we don't know who you're here to meet. And they're like, you want to interview this guy? And he liked him and he eventually became part of the ownership group of that company.
That's fantastic. What we historians call contingency. Oh my gosh, I love that. That's great. So why do I think of you in, is it the mailbox store or UPS? What is,
yeah, much later in life. So after when Thomson Reuters bought out that company, my dad retired. He didn't want to stay on at Thomson. And then he and my mother and my youngest sister, who had been in banking, kind of doing work with small banks, they bought a UPS store. And so now that's kind of our family business.
Okay.
That's helpful. Nominal owner of that, but not really. But you'll see me there often in the summers or during Christmas on Saturdays.
I know. We've discussed sometimes young employees not showing up or calling in sick, and no one is there. But even your sister isn't there.
Oh, and COVID. I mean, I really feel for business owners now. Unemployment in Minnesota is so low.
Yeah,
and you know that particular business never slowed down at all. It really has been growing the whole time. So. Keeping the doors open is a surprising concept.
Is there more than one store around the metro or just in St. Paul?
Oh, no, there's UPS stores. I think there's probably 30 or 40 of them in Minnesota, but we own just the one. It's just
a franchise. You own the one. It's a franchise. Okay. I wonder. I used to go to the one in Uptown here in Minneapolis. So I was wondering.
Oh, that's a nice store. Yeah.
Yeah. Wondering if that was one of yours. So you're already interested in, were you a debater in high school? Were you doing speech and debate? It sounds like.
Yeah. So the way it worked, I took, we had a language sample that included Russian, and then I decided to keep taking Russian. And if you did that, the way your schedule worked, and you also did speech and debate, you could avoid math. That's exactly why I did it. I'm like, well, I don't like math. And then I found I really liked debate, immediately like speech and debate, but you could join in ninth grade, and then you had to do, if you did each of the speech events, speech was kind of an extra add-on. So if you did each of the speech events, you could travel with the varsity squad. You didn't have to be good at them, but you had to do everything once. And I loved my coach for making me do that. I was the world's worst interp reader. I was just god awful as interp. I mean, a piece that you would laugh till you cried just reading it. And when I performed it, it was so awful. But it was worth doing because you understand kind of the skill sets that go along with that. So
what was it?
The debate. I want to say it was Confessions of a Burglar by Woody Allen. It was laugh out loud funny.
Had I known that, I would have, urged you to do it for the podcast, but well, maybe another time. What was it? You said you really loved it. What was it about speech and debate back then that you loved about it? Maybe still.
You know, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but something when it's first explained to you and it immediately makes perfect sense. That's how I felt about how how the stock issues of a policy debate worked and why debate would allow you to speech and debate particularly is about uncertainty reduction. So policy debate is all about thinking about in a social realm where you're trying to arrive at social knowledge, not scientific knowledge necessarily, but policy knowledge. You're trying to reduce the risks of undesirable outcomes and you're trying to solve dynamic problems that may have inputs that you don't understand. So you may not fully understand the cause but all of that immediately made sense to me. And when I was very young, went to the Hill Reference Library in St. Paul. Wonderful, beautiful library building. Walked in there and I think the next youngest person was probably in their 40s. So the librarian like jumped around from the desk and said, oh, I think you're supposed to be over at the St. Paul Library on the other side.
Yeah, like your dad. You're supposed to be a Western, whatever.
Right. And I said, no, I said, I came here because I understand you might have access to the fatal accident reporting system. And I need to know how many people were electrocuted by home appliances last year. We're debating consumer product safety. And after that, I kind of became the library mascot. So every Saturday, I showed up with a different question. And the reference librarians were so terrific and so helpful. And it really opened my eyes to the idea of disciplines of research. It's like, research and development, you may be able to turn these business cost harm arguments into advantages because R&D will have side spinoffs. So these businesses will develop new. So things like that immediately made sense. And really, that's what led me through. That's what kind of got me interested in college. Hadn't it been for speech and debate, I might not have gone to college, but kind of learning, you know, well, now we're going to debate transportation, so we're going to the engineering library. And now we're debating oceans, so we're going to do maritime research. And kind of learning how legal research is different.
Yes.
You know, all of that, I think a lot when I see kind of mediocre public policy debates now on television.
Right, it must drive you crazy.
Oh, but I often think, you know, all of those lessons I learned in ninth grade, what's the difference between correlation and causation? And how do I test bias in a source? And how do I think about consensus? And how do I think about kind of minimizing risk in fallback positions so that, you know, doing something in a demonstration project before I bring it nationwide? All of those are things I think I learned in ninth grade and very grateful for it.
That's so cool. I can relate. I loved arguing. I was very argumentative. Maybe some people say I still am. Some people close to me in particular, family. But my dad encouraged it. He had gone to college, as I said. I think we were talking before we started recording. Anyway, but he would set up almost, I realize now, it's almost like moot court, you know, where except that he was the judge, the prosecutor, yes, and the jury. I love that. And then in right around, I guess it would have been junior high, seventh and eighth grade, Mr. Radcliffe, I could still picture him. I'm pretty sure it was a debate class I took. I remember having the index cards, and I just loved being able to make an argument. But I also remember Mr. Radcliffe, this is, God, a long time ago. His critique of my presentation was to, when I was done, climb onto the desk, the front of the room, the teacher's desk, lie down on it. He was kind of short. Put his head in his hand and say, "This is how boring you were," something like that. You know, does this look or sound exciting? So my tone was not quite right. But I admire debaters. I completely, you know, agree with you about watching so-called policy debates or presidential debates. I mean, come on. Especially thinking about, you know, the old good old days, like the Lincoln Douglas debates and
yes.
So you went, you mentioned college, and I didn't mention in the intro where you went, but it's Augustana Sioux Falls, right? Liberal arts college. And did you go, it seems like, you know, looking at your CV, like you kind of knew what you wanted to do. Is that accurate? I want to major in speech or whatever it was called.
Yes. Yeah. Very much went there for, again, as a first gen, I wasn't really on top of the application process. And so I originally only applied at one school, which was McAllister, which retrospect was quite a reach for me. Huh. So I got in there and late in the process. So I want to say in mid-May, it occurred to me that that was not going to work, that I was too close to home. And okay. Something my parents said, like my mom and dad were reading through my materials. My mom said, "Oh, look, these lectures are free. We could come to them." And that was the first time it occurred to me. I'm like, "Oh my God, they're only like 10 miles away. I'm just going to drop in with no notice. Like, I've got to get out of this place." So I'd gone to a summer workshop at Augustana, and I knew the coach there, and he had tried to recruit me. And I called him and said, "I know it's late, but if that offer is still open," because they'd offered a very generous scholarship. And that's where that's how I made that choice. Again, if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't advise it. It's a very risky strategy. But went to Augustana, had a great experience there, and then went from there to the University of Kansas. I had planned on going to law school, but at KU they said, "Well, why not get a master's degree? And we've got this really interesting guy down here that teaches theoretical persuasion, and he's the authority." Tom Biesecker was his name. He's the authority on jury behavior consulting.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
So he does all this theoretical persuasion stuff, which I was kind of interested in too. And then immediately fell in love with it. Like all thoughts of law school went away within the first semester as a graduate student. I'm like, "Oh, this is exactly what I want to do with the rest of my life."
That's great. And then from there to the U, and again in what was it called there? Speech and communication at the U?
Communication studies department there, because they've got a rhetoric department too, which is also more technical. So they've got like a rhetoric department on the St. Paul campus, which is technical communication. And then what we normally think of as media studies, critical media studies, communication studies.
Okay.
On the other bank.
What was the focus of your dissertation there?
So I looked at the use of humor as a foil to cover up political attacks and negative political advertising. So if you remember Paul Wellstone's wonderful campaign.
Yes.
And nearby in Wisconsin, Russ Feingold, a couple of years later, did it. And ironically, Dee Huddleston and Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. And Mitch McConnell had wonderful ads in his very first campaign for Congress where he used these bloodhounds searching for Dee Huddleston, you know, searching all over Kentucky because I can find him in Jamaica. I can find him at these fancy restaurants on the coast. But where is Dee Huddleston? So he had these hound dogs in the sky in a trench coat pretending to be searching for Dee Huddleston. So the focus of my research was how you can inject humor into what is basically a sometimes even a strikingly negative message. And the audience does not perceive it as negative, right? So yes. Somebody like Wellstone, some of his ads were, if you just took the audio track, were very, very negative. He did this wonderful one with kids, kind of kids coloring on these oversized checks. But the audio track over that was kind of like, children don't have campaign money, and so my opponent doesn't care about children. And so there were various ways in which humor worked to kind of cover up that negativity. He got praised a lot for not being negative. And it's like, well, that's a really negative ad, actually, when you look at it. And so that's what my dissertation focused on was kind of
that. That's great. Ad. And I just learned that Mitch McConnell had a sense of humor, or at least his ad people did. And that's funny.
Who knew? I mean, now when I look at him, I'm like, oh, Mitch, how far you come?
Exactly. What was the time frame, roughly speaking, for the research? Was it 20th century or late post-war?
Oh, no, it was all contemporary campaigns. So it was, I think the formal title of my dissertation was Comic Political Media Style in U.S. Senate Races. And it was from, I'd say, 1988. I did do a couple of radio. I looked at a couple of radio campaigns, too, but from 1988 through probably 1994, pretty narrow in scope.
I can't help but thinking of Lincoln and Lincoln Douglas debates and Lincoln's use of humor, about which a lot has been actually, there's a fairly new book out about that by David Reynolds, a literary scholar, about just Lincoln's use of popular culture at the time and certainly humor. To get a point across.
I think late in my career, I'm going back to humor studies because it was such fun research and, again, inherently interdisciplinary. So, I think we talked before about Art Geffen at the University of Minnesota. So he's a great, terrific guy. Started in vaudeville and then becomes this English professor and literary critic. And he do these seminars where you're looking at the psychology of humor and humor as a sociological construct. You know, why do different ethnic styles of humor evolve or develop? And just really, really interesting intersection of a bunch of different areas of research.
Yeah, I find it very interesting. At Boston University, when I was there for my PhD work, I TA'd for him. I didn't take classes with him, but he was kind of on my dissertation committee. Joseph Boskin, who'd gone to the U, by the way, in history, but he worked on humor. And particularly, he has a wonderful book called Sambo about that figure. But then he gets into Jack Benny and Rochester and Benny's kind of counterpart on the Jack Benny show. But he did another book on humor. I can't remember the title. I just found that's where I kind of encountered humor as something one could study. You know, you didn't have to just read Mark Twain and laugh. You could watch Hal Holbrook. You could actually study it. I didn't study it, but I find it very interesting. So, yeah, go back to it. You've got plenty of time to do that. And you didn't go into law, but sometimes when I see you, if I see you in your bow tie, I don't know if you wear that anymore on campus, but you certainly look like a counselor to me. You mentioned the interdisciplinary nature of the work. Let's talk a little bit about that. Tell us a little bit about what is comp studies. Give us a definition of that discipline. I know we'll come back to that later when we get to the liberal arts, but go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the things that drew me to communication studies was the more or less inherently interdisciplinary nature of the work. So we have people in our field that use qualitative, quantitative, rhetorical, critical, you know, borrow methods from other fields. And that's really what interests me a lot about those projects is that you are drawing upon different fields. So like the work I'm doing right now I'm focusing a lot on museum curation and how identity is constructed in these narratives within national museums. And really, that's historical work primarily, or at least you can't do it well unless you get the history part of it right. But also there are aspects of it that are performative, and there are certainly visual aspects of it that make a big difference, and presentational aspects of it that make a big difference. And then there are rhetorical pieces, right, about why is this particular text persuasive to certain communities, and who does it leave out? And I do think that's interesting. So I think persuasion is such a broad and amorphous piece. It's psychology is part of persuasion.
Yes. So
logic is part of persuasion.
That's right.
The evidence you marshal is part of persuasion. And like Patty is great at performance. We're looking at performative pieces. And I'm not a great judge of that, but certainly can at least recognize that performances are better than others.
You're talking about Patricia English, your colleague.
Patricia English. And so I may not have the language to put into words kind of why I found that more compelling and why I found another performance weaker, but I can at least recognize that it did succeed in persuading me. So that's part of what I like about when I was at KU and I was really focused on message design and kind of theoretical persuasion. I was obsessed with this idea that you could take rhetorical constructs and then you could run them through batteries of basically social psychology texts.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not unlike what modern advertising is.
Exactly. Right.
But I really wanted to look at fundraising appeals and these compliance gating strategies and see if I could figure out what's the most effective way in any circumstance. And, you know, it didn't work. But the process of studying it was really interesting. I'm like, oh, there's so much more here, and I can see why some scholars in our field really almost have more in common with psychologists.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, just thinking about my familiarity with what you and your colleagues do, it's incredibly interdisciplinary. It just reminded me, too, I can picture this teacher perfectly. I don't remember her name. It was in high school, and we had, maybe it was required. This would have been in the late 60s, I started in 67. Anyway, media studies course, which I found, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to articulate it this way at the time, but I loved it because it was, in fact, interdisciplinary, right? We were doing radio, television, we were looking at psychology, I remember, or, you know, persuasion. Don't know about history, but you know, certainly politics, I remember, and debate, all of that stuff I just found so interesting. So thank you for that. We'll come back to that. We get into the liberal arts later. You're also, are you still the director of forensics? Is that still a position you hold, or you were, I know?
The college really has kind of folded that into the dialogue and deliberation program. So okay. We really have a student-run forensics program now. They still do travel. They were at our national tournament last year. And I've got one more year on the national board at Pi Kappa Delta. They're kind of replacing me then, so I'll be stepping down from that.
Okay. Is that something I assume you enjoyed doing that at Gustavus? I mean, you were certainly damn good at it.
Really loved it. But, you know, the travel is so hard.
Yeah.
It really is. It was a joyous thing to do for many, many years. But it also is kind of a young person's game because it's, you know, leaving on a Thursday and then you're driving to Kansas for a 4-day tournament and getting back at midnight and teaching the next day.
I'm sitting here smiling, kind of laughing because you're someone who's traveled what around. I mean, travel is your thing, man. 70 countries in 10 years or something. I think of you, if you're not in your office, you might be on an airplane somewhere, you know, going somewhere. I mean, I remember just talking, you were, you know, overhearing you planning the travel. It's a lot for the students as well, too. So if a student were to come to Gustavus and wanted to do debate, let's say, or speech, can they still do that through this student-run organization?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. No, we have a student group, and they travel the tournaments, and it's kind of student-run. They get their budget from the student organization, and then we have some monies within the department that we can help them out if they need, you know, extra funding to go to a national tournament or something. But okay. They definitely can still do speech and debate at Gustavus. And really, that's the kind of model. More and more schools are doing that. So schools of our size with, you know, fully funded programs and faculty involved are becoming more and more rare just because of the way that college financing is working.
Well, that's interesting.
Hard to fund.
I didn't know that.
I would imagine as an undergraduate, so if you can imagine this, my entire career at Augustana, we traveled an average of 22 tournaments a year.
Wow.
Now, it wasn't always with the same coach, right? They had multiple coaches, but we were missing all of those school days. And we flew, I'd imagine half of those were to the East or West Coast. So we flew 10, 12 times a year. Just think of the cost for that to send four students abroad plus a coach.
Right.
10, 12 times a year at their hotel. I'm very sympathetic to colleges saying, look, back when student populations were growing and we were getting all of this federal money, you know, we could afford programs like this. Now to do that kind of travel is really difficult.
Well, so it's interesting to me. So Gustavus is not kind of out in left field in this regard. It's kind of a trend or where small college debate and speech is headed. And by the way, I remember sometimes overhearing you, like the logistics, God, that you had to, the planning you had to do, even just for the adults, right? Sometimes you were, I think, planning, maybe it was for Pi Kappa Delta, some conference or something. It's such incredibly complicated.
I will not be sorry to lose that.
Okay.
And we were running the national tournament. So this last tournament we ran in Florida was a sit-down banquet for 1,000.
Good Lord.
At a 5-day affair, 1,500 competitors. Thank God I was not running the tournament part. I was just doing the tournament registration and payment. And then a luncheon. We did a pizza luncheon. We did a Hall of Fame reception, a Hall of Fame dinner.
Good Lord.
And I thought, it's like being a wedding planner.
Well, you're just taking the words out of my mouth. Yes. Well, I don't know. You have the talent, but it's, I was just about to say event planner. That's exactly what it is.
Oh, my God. You know, and they were asking us questions like, what color tablecloths do you want? I'm like, isn't there someone local that would be a better? I'm like, I've never been to your campus. I don't know what your union looks like.
Wow.
So well, I'm happy to give that to a younger person.
You're done with that or almost done with that. So the other piece, of course, of your work is teaching. Let's talk a little. I want to talk about the international ed, especially the Vietnam, Cambodia travel in a second. But before that, what about I find reality TV both, maybe like a lot of people, absolutely repellent and fascinating, you know, maybe like a car wreck or a train wreck. And I suppose that's a cliche. But in any case, you teach a course and it sounds like you're going to teach a first term seminar this fall on it. Tell us a little bit about how you got into that and what you focus on there.
Well, we were doing a course on documentary film, which was a film theory course, kind of based in the rhetoric of documentary film, I think was the title of the course, and started noticing all of these artifacts that didn't fit. It's like, well, it's a truth claim, and it's factual, so it's popular factual television, but it's definitely not a documentary. And that's really what started us. We kind of broke those two courses apart. And so all of the reality television courses focus on how truth claims are curated and cultivated in these texts that are often untruthful. We look at the effect of it. You know, it's a cultural criticism and an audience studies course, and it really, really interrogates how does television construct these broad categories like gender and race and class, and how are these communicated to people kind of unknowingly through these texts that aspire to be truth.
And I mean, obviously, this couldn't be more timely, to say the least.
Yes.
And we've got a former president who comes out of reality television. We've got, the whole, what did Colbert call it? Truthiness or something like that.
Yes.
That is. And then the way you look at the constructions of gender, race, et cetera, in it, I think is extremely interesting. So is that's going to be the focus of the first term seminar?
The first term seminar is called Food, Television, and the Pleasures of Consumption. And so it's going to look at how it's kind of an overview of the history of food television. I've never had more fun putting a course together. I don't know if the students will like it, but I've had a ball. And it's going to look at kind of how does reality television kind of paper over our unfortunate history. So a lot of the food television courses, or I'm sorry, a lot of the food programs that we're looking at, historical food programs, will praise the kind of craftiness of Southern foods. You know, look at how crafty they were using these ingredients. They're so resourceful that they use everything. It's like, well, ignoring kind of what are the reasons why that was true,
right?
Why this type of cuisine resulted, or how do these programs communicate themes of abundance, and where that may not be true. I'm going to have a ball doing it. It's really
it sounds great, and it sounds like a course I need to take since I am a food television addict. And you just remind me, what's the recent show? Is it about Southern, maybe barbecue? It's about barbecue. I can't remember what it's called. Really good show. High on the Hog. Documentary.
That is a great. I'm going to show. Yeah. I struggle because there's so many good.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
Show. But yes, I am going to show one segment of that long format documentary. Where he starts in Africa?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to show that episode as kind of an entree to American food. I
think starts with this premise
that American food originated in Africa. Let's start there. Modern reality TV program really does start
precisely.
There.
Yeah,
This is an element of discovering the West. I'm like, that was a surprise to the people that lived there for thousands of years.
Yeah, Southern cooking has something to do with slavery, and yeah, exactly.
And it's really, you know, the other thing that I think is going to be interesting is. It is sometimes difficult to get students to talk about values.
Yes.
But when you suddenly start talking about the difference between a matter of taste and now make that a value argument. And so I've got some outrageous food reviews that are hilarious, and some of them are just really punchy. So there's one that's kind of this very high critic who reviews this gastronomical and molecular food restaurant. Kind of the whole gist of the critique is kind of, where's the meal? Like, I've never spent more money on something. I'm like, there was a wisp of something, a puff of this, and we got something on a cracker and the $200 check. The only thing we really ate was the wine. I feel so hungry. And I thought that I've got that. And then I got another one with just very strong opinions. And I'm going to ask students to identify a food way. I think every ethnicity has a food way that other outsiders would find appalling or disgusting or unethical. And so in my family's Polish. And so I remember being horrified going down to my grandmother's refrigerator, opening it, and there's a hog's head in there.
Yeah.
And she's being made. And so I think that's a great way to get them to think about, how do I make an argument about taste that also gets over that kind of element of intersubjectivity?
Yes.
And then how do I defend the value, right? So if it is a matter of taste, how do I present criteria by which I can defend my choice, and rather than just saying, well, I like it and you don't, and that's the end of it.
It's like, right.
No, there are actually ways in which we can.
Yeah, that's great. That sounds like a fantastic course. And you mentioned values, which is a component of our first term seminar program at Gustavus. Boy, now I want to take the course. And the other show, my mind is going, running rapidly here, racing. But, I don't know if it's relevant, but the show The Bear, have you read about that? The restaurant show called The Bear,
set in Chicago.
You've got to watch it. You'll love it. It's the first season. And it's everyone is saying it's the – I loved it just because it was set in Chicago. But really, really good show about what it's like to work in a tiny, tiny restaurant. There's this sort of star chef who's trying to save his brother's place. And there's stuff on gender and race. I think you really like it. Your students might like it too. Anyway, go ahead.
That's one of the problems is, when we first started doing the reality TV course, we built into the course kind of a political economy piece about it. Like, why is it so inexpensive to produce, and how does it really bust the labor markets of the writers and actors and
set? Well, that's interesting.
How do I get free labor? I mean, it merges with the social media course.
Yeah.
About prosumption, right? You got these free laborers kind of producing something for you, and you're just providing the venue. But way back then, I used to, on the final, I'd have an essay question that said, pretend I'm a producer and pitch me a new reality show.
Oh, that's excellent. Right?
And now, honestly, Greg, I'll bet there are 10,000 of them. And I've just been wading through these cooking shows. There must be, I can't just pick a date and say, I'm not going to look at any more shows for this semester, because I was going down this rabbit hole. I'm like, and you've got the competition shows and the recipe shows.
Right.
One's about the various ingredients, and the ones that approach it as a matter of health, and the ones that approach it primarily through the prism of class. So it is an interesting enterprise in narrow casting as well. Like,
five
channel network that we grew up with, right?
Right.
Five choices. You never could have something like
Hilda. No, you're taking the words out of my mouth. I mean, it was Julia, right? Whatever, the Julia Child, PBS.
Yeah, Julia Child.
But then, I mean, you know, I think I read the creator of the, I don't know if I'm making it, I remember reading somewhere the creator of the Food Network Channel or whatever it was called, sort of, you know, people saying, who's going to watch that all day? Well, you know, right. Here we are. Yes. Me, you, and millions of other people.
Well, and anyway. I mean, if you think about the advertising, right, to the economics of that, right?
Right.
If you've got a network, or now I think we have two 24-hour-a-day fishing networks. Just let that sink in. So you think about the most obscure thing, you're like, really, people watch fishing on TV? That just doesn't seem like a thing, but it is a thing. And of course, if I'm selling a $10,000 bass buggy, that's the ideal population.
Sure, exactly. So
there's something for everyone on American television, no matter how arcane the...
Well, I'm going to talk to you about your course. I might want to drop in now and then. Sounds fantastic, really. And a lot of fun, too. The other piece of your teaching, there's so much we could talk about, but I do want to talk about the international ed piece, because you've done so much of that. And especially, what have you done, 4 or 5 trips with students to Vietnam and Cambodia? The last one was it during COVID, right? As COVID was just starting.
Yeah, it had started. And so it was already endemic in Ho Chi Minh City. You know, we get the English-speaking paper like 2 days later. Okay. So by the time we get the news, they're like, oh, all the masks are gone. Oh, there's no hand sanitizer. I had to go buy this big gallon-sized jug of hand sanitizer at a medical supply store. You know, same thing that happened here. And immediately, I ordered on Amazon for my family. I started immediately ordering these supplies for delivery before I even came home, because I'm like, oh, this is going to empty this place out. And it was weird because the students went home. We had to cut that course short by 1 day.
Okay.
But wow. I stayed through touring week. I stayed an extra 11 days. I didn't go home. And so suddenly the malls were empty. You know, the last day the students were there on a Saturday, we went to the Ho Chi Minh City Zoo, and it was filled with thousands of people. I went there 7 days later, and at 3 p.m, I was the 212th person to enter.
Wow.
It was just eerie. It was like dropping a neutron bomb, and just all the people were gone.
Yeah.
Wow. But I don't know if you went abroad during...
No.
I never did.
No,
I always, it never even would have occurred to me. And so I'm really quite an evangelist for international education.
Oh, going abroad when I was a student? I did. Yes, I did. I went to Mexico. I thought you meant, did I go abroad during COVID? No, absolutely not.
Oh, no.
I never went.
As an undergraduate, I would have thought, no, that's not for me. It's going to be really expensive.
Yeah, I did. It was transformative. I went with my then girlfriend, who was fluent in Spanish. We went to Mexico for a semester, and I absolutely loved it. I mean, it was completely so. I'm an evangelist also. I mean, it just was. But talk to us a little bit about that's one of my questions. So why are you an evangelist and why Vietnam? What? I mean, I know you've been to London, India, you know, but you've gone back repeatedly to Vietnam. What is it about that place that attracts you as a teacher, as an evangelist for international ed?
Growing up, we had a Vietnamese family that lived with us the fall of Saigon. The Catholic Church was kind of sponsoring refugees, and so we had a family of 5 that stayed with us. And so I've always been interested in Vietnam, and I don't
know if
you grew up kind of watching the war on TV.
Absolutely.
I very much did. So I followed that, you know, compulsively. One of my earliest recollections, the earliest thing I can remember, is sitting on the porch listening to WCCO radio and asking my mom, what's a troop? Because they were talking about the troop counts.
Yeah.
So I've always been interested in that area, and the course is really, really wonderful as an experience for students who don't have a lot of history there. I mean, it's a very young country. It's kind of it allows them to kind of explore things at their own pace, and that's part of why the podcast, I think, works well, is some of the museums we do are terrible museums. So in Vietnam, right after the revolution, every province got a revolutionary museum, and they really were kind of made out of kits. They were just, you know, same pictures, the same kind of hokey captions. And so some of the places we take them, not because the museum itself is really engaging, but because we want them to watch how other people are experiencing the museum.
Oh, yeah.
And allowing them to do the podcast kind of makes them journalists in those times when they're disengaged. But I think it's a really interesting place to study identity formation because of the Civil War and because of the colonial experience, you have all of these different influences on how people construct their own nationalist narrative.
Yes.
And so, and it's complicated, and different generations kind of think of it differently. So there are a lot of things that the Vietnamese would consider Vietnamese, and you'd say, well, that's, it's kind of French too.
It's like, yes.
I'm a native here. So you think of this kind of as your national sandwich, but really the baguette was an import and kind of a colonial residue. And so there are people that fight over those types of things.
You know, yeah, that's, I find that stuff fascinating. And you mentioned food, and of course the food, I mean, I only know Vietnamese, Southeast Asian food from here. I've never traveled to that part of the world, but, you know, fabulous food, I would imagine, as well in the countries. You know, talk to us a little bit about how, I mean, what did you learn, what the students learn about how Vietnam presents the war, what we might call the U.S. war against or in Vietnam. How does that come across?
It has changed so much since we started going there. So when we started going there, one of the main museums in Ho Chi Minh City was called the Museum of American War Crimes.
Okay.
And it was very, very graphic in terms of how it presented these war crimes. It was full of kind of gory pictures and displays. And you used to enter it through this very, very tightly confined little one-way, kind of a little shack at the front, this L-shaped shack, and that was the main entrance. You walk through these displays of all the journalists that were killed during the war, northern journalists, southern journalists, people from Australia. And so it wasn't the most engaging exhibit for students, but immediately on the other side of that, you were confronted by victims who had lost limbs because of Agent Orange. And they had these, and they would try and they'd come up to the American students and they would offer to shake their stumps, and American students would recoil. So there'd always be people backed up. And it was right at the other side of that when you were entering into the main courtyard where they had all the weapons. I think it was intentional that the Vietnamese government allowed those people to sell books there and to sell postcards there in that lobby.
Boy, that's incredible.
And it was just a real impact experience, totally unexpected by the students. You're in this kind of boring display, and here's a picture of this journalist, and little statement about when they died. And they weren't really engaged by that. And then they're immediately shocked by it.
Sure.
Well, they flash forward 20 years in the future, right? They're no longer the kind of scrappy revolutionary regime fighting the imperialists and standing with international Marxism against the global forces of capitalism. Now the museum is presenting a kind of more universalizing themes of war and loss. And so now it's the War Remnants Museum rather than the War Crimes Museum. The Army of the Southern Republic has almost totally disappeared. So there used to be a lot of displays that kind of referred to them as either dupes, or some of it you could tell was influenced by the Chinese, because they talk about Americans as imperialist running dogs, capitalist running dogs, and their puppet regime. Now they're almost totally gone. Rarely see the army, the Arvin, reflected at all, or they're in the background of these pictures. And you'll see new exhibits that get at these more universal themes. So rather than having the kind of confrontational approach of Agent Orange victims in the courtyard, there are these just heartbreaking pictures drawn by children, cartoon pictures drawn by children that show them without limbs, and then little thought bubbles of what would I look like if I hadn't encountered Agent Orange. And, you know, so that's that in a nutshell is how the country has remade itself. So it's moving from a story of its nationhood that's rooted in kind of scrappiness and revolutionary zeal into a story of modern Vietnam, which of course wants the expats back, and it wants the diaspora back, and it wants American investors, and it wants tourism. And for many, many people, the war is not even really a memory. I mean, it's such a young country.
Sure.
We encountered for the first time a totally surprising narrative. So one of our guides was leading us through this smaller Ho Chi Minh Museum in Ho Chi Minh City, and kind of said, what do you think about the war? And, you know, everybody's kind of guarded. And what we didn't expect, which she said, she had been a refugee from the western part near Cambodia. Her village had been bombed. One of her cousins was killed. One of her aunts was killed. And yet she said, how come you abandon us? And the students were so surprised. Like,
that's
like, if you'd stayed, we would be like Korea, you know, but look at where we're at now. Look at the difference between us. If you, you know, how come America gave up on us? And they were totally, that was a totally unexpected
That's thing. Incredible.
Even where she started, it was a war refugee. And I lived on the streets in Ho Chi Minh City for several years.
Oh, I love that.
But it's a very complicated place. So you will find elements of people who are bitter that the kind of, that the state isn't more communist, that it's not a more centrally planned workers' paradise, that it is becoming more like a capitalist state. It's all there. So I do think that it's an interesting place for students to think about their own subject point of view and how their own personal histories affect how they filter in information and how they interpret what this grand narrative means.
Right.
What, what's the purpose?
It's perfect. And how, whatever national histories, memories they bring as, you know, if they're born in this country and gone to, you know, school and learned all the history lessons they're supposed to learn, you know, what they bring to those exhibits.
I was so proud of one of our students. We had a student there whose uncle had been in what was called the Hanoi Hilton, the Ha Long prison. And, they were going through, and the first part of the tour is all about this was a French colonial prison, and look at how primitive the conditions are, and it's so cold, and it's so wet, and people die of these diseases, and the rats can get into your cells, and there's no glass on the windows. Just to be located here is inherently an act of torture, right? Then they move to the other part of the prison, which focuses on John McCain. Look at the American prisoners. They play tennis. They were so well-fed and well-treated. And one of our students, this is all of the guides were Communist Party officials. Now it's self-guided. Okay. One of our students said, well, I thought you said it was inherently tortured to be kept in a place like this. And they kind of looked at it like, the tour is over. Exit through the kitchen. And it was a very abrupt kind of like, we didn't have a script for these types of questions.
Right. Critical speaking.
One of the guides said, we weren't expecting questions.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, it sounds like a fantastic course. It's a part of the world I want to go to. I assume you're going to offer it again, and you've done it with Patty English, right? The two of you?
Yes. We are doing it this January.
Okay.
Hopefully, again, God willing, we're only doing Vietnam, not Cambodia. Okay.
Not Cambodia. Yeah.
Because we're afraid that in the, you know, immediate aftermath of the pandemic, that if it were to kind of flare up again, it would be hard to cross national borders.
Sure.
Looking forward to it.
It sounds like a fantastic course. And again, I'm highly interdisciplinary. As we're winding down here, we talked about, you know, you gave us that definition of comp studies and how interdisciplinary it is. I wonder now, as we close, if you could make the case for comp studies at Gustavus, your major, your department, and also for the liberal arts. Unlike some profs, I'm one of them at Gustavus. You know, not all of us attended a liberal arts college. You did. My wife, Kate, did. I used to teach in the history department, went to Bard College. But go ahead, take that away.
Well, you know, certainly every department deals with elements of communication, right? So we don't own kind of the study of communication or communication as variable. But the centrality of that in our field means that we probably approach it as a more significant variable than anywhere else. And so as a liberal arts piece, I think whether you're interested in economics and management, or you're interested in psychology, or you're interested in education, probably a communication studies course would be a benefit for you, even if you didn't get a major or get a minor. And I think it fits really well within the college, the kind of housing our two new initiatives, the kind of discourse program and the deliberation program, both are ways of kind of leveraging that interdisciplinarity. So in public discourse, students find a problem of their own devices and create a solution that they're going to actually implement in the community. And of course, that is by definition an interdisciplinary enterprise, because these communities are going to have different types of problems which will require different resources to go about solving. In a way, it's kind of not unlike our challenge seminar. I know we were at that piece this summer thinking about challenge seminars. I've kind of come back to really misinformation is the great challenge in my field. So I am going to do a course on that. I'm not going to do the kind of easier, funner project one. I'm like, oh, there's a lot of things that would be interesting there. But really, that is a great challenge, right? If you think about that's something
absolutely.
That everything else that we do, and how we encounter misinformation, how do we get people to think critically, how we get people to arrive at the truth.
Right. I think that's maybe the greatest challenge to democracy, too, to our system of democracy, democratic republic, whatever you want to call it. That I'm happy you solved that problem. What's that challenge? Yeah, exactly. What you're going to do for the challenge seminar? Part of our new curriculum. Yeah, that's good. But it's fun for me. It's fun for me overhearing you and conversing with you and your colleagues, Martin Lang and Patty and others, because so much of that is of interest to me personally, but also intersects with history in so many ways. I mean, one of my heroes, well, Lincoln is a hero. I know I can hear some people saying, oh, he's a racist. We can talk about that. But for the way he spoke, I mean, his voice was, we would not find it pleasant, but the way he spoke, the way he used language, both in speaking and writing, and Frederick Douglass, the greatest orator of the 19th century. Anyway, all extremely interesting. Students, if you are listening, prospective students as well, take Professor Voigt's courses, take the Vietnam J-Term with Professor English and Phil, because I highly recommend all of that. So we could go on. I've learned already stuff I did not know about the South St. Paul. I just thought Phil grew up in St. Paul. I didn't know about that. We did a walking tour of that area, which was really interesting, by the way, some years ago. I found that quite interesting with a historian, retired historian from McAllister.
Yeah, it was cool. Down at the stockyards?
Around there, yeah. I don't think we actually got to that. I can't remember if we got to the stockyard. I don't think we did. But when I hear stockyards, that, of course, brings back, memories of my childhood in Chicago. I didn't grow up near the stockyards, but we would go to certain restaurants were stockyard themed near the stockyards. Kind of crazy. Chairs with, the skin of cattle, that sort of thing. Oh, man. And, of course, reading The Jungle, right? I mean,
right.
It's a great book. But anyway, it's really been fun and interesting. We will see each other in our offices this fall, before long, 4 weeks. So all the best as you get ready for that. And best of luck with the work you're doing on courses and publications. I know related to what you were telling us about the museums and national identity in Vietnam. So just good luck with all of that. It's all really interesting. And thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you, Greg. This is great.
Yeah. Take care, Phil. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.